This is Roland, your volunteer reader at Sun Sounds of Arizona, with today's reading of the Arizona Daily Star. On the front page, Tucson business owners watching for lasting impact from mass shooting. The yellow police tape cordoning off East Congress Street Sunday didn't come down until the better part of the day had passed. Most of the businesses along that stretch between South Fifth Avenue and South Stone Avenue were forced to keep their doors closed while police investigated the nearby scene of Sunday's early morning mass shooting that left 10 people injured, including the suspect. An employee of Iguana Cafe and Bar at 210 East Congress said Monday that employees couldn't get past the barriers and neither could customers. It was the same for employees at the two-week-old Gibson Food Hall and Market around the corner at 11 South 6th Avenue. "I don't think any of us understood really the impact until the next morning," said Nick Wayne Eggman, who with his business partner John Harden owns Gibson and the High Wire Tucson Bar and Lounge behind the Market on South Arizona Avenue. "We figured the cops will clear out, we'll open as usual." Eggman got a heads up to the shooting early Sunday, not long after High Wire patrons were starting to filter out just after 2 a.m. Eggman said his employees reported hearing what sounded like gunshots, but it took the blaring sirens descending on the 100 block of East Congress before anyone understood the gravity of the situation. "Anytime there's gun violence, and for whatever reason this happens time to time downtown, it's very scary," Eggman said. "It's not good for business, not good for Tucson. Unfortunately, you know it's a fact of life. These things do happen." "There's just this kind of ripple of fear, you know, uneasiness," said longtime downtown restaurateur Ray Flores, whose family's El Charo Cafe has been in business downtown for more than a century. The family also operates Charo's Steak and Del Rey on East Broadway and the Monica on East Congress near South Church Avenue. "We have owned and operated in the urban core. We're used to things that have been going on for generations down there. But the recent level of violence, including the deadly hatchet attack on a tourist in spring 2025, has a chilling effect that compounds a challenge we have in downtown that no Rio Nuevo investment can fix, which is a perception that that's the reality," Flores said, referring to the downtown redevelopment taxing district. Eggman also wonders what sort of long-term impact Sunday's shooting will have on people's perception of downtown. "If Monday was any indication," he says he's encouraged. "It's not even noon yet, and there's people already having lunch," he said. In the next few weeks, Grant Kruger hopes to open his long-awaited Block A Sports Bar and Grill in the former home of Hi-Fi Kitchen and Cocktails at 345 East Congress. Kruger said he and his Union Hospitality Group, Union Public House, Reforma Modern Mexican, Proof Artisanal Pizza and Pasta, are coming downtown to be part of the solution, not to worry about the problem. "This is a tremendous tragedy. It's also a numbers game that at some point something like this can or will happen in just about any urban city," Kruger said. "I'm from Detroit, Michigan, originally, and so we know a few things or two about crime in Detroit, and there's not any place in Tucson as scary as coming from a city like Detroit." Latino voters key to governor race. The road for Katie Hobbs to keep the governor's office in the November election could lead through the Hispanic community in Arizona. Hobbs acknowledges that means convincing those who voted for Donald Trump in 2024 and gave him a winning margin here that they should support her versus presumed Republican nominee Andy Biggs, who has aligned himself with the president and is boasting of his endorsement. "I am focused on doing everything I can to deliver for Arizonans. That includes Latino families," Hobbs said Monday when her campaign unveiled Familias Primero, Families First, its coalition of Latino leaders, community members, and local elected officials. But what it also means, according to Rachel Terran, a former chair of the Arizona Democratic Party and a member of the new coalition, is that Hobbs needs to pick up at least two-thirds of the Hispanic vote to overcome what even the governor concedes are numbers that could be seen as working against her. Hobbs pointed out that she is only one of two Democratic governors seeking re-election this year in a state that Trump won in 2024, in Arizona's case, by 5.5%. By contrast, her own 17,117-vote victory over Republican Carrie Lake in 2022 was by just 0.7%. And this in a state where, while political independents make up a third of registered voters, Republicans still outnumber Democrats in Arizona by more than 313,000, close to 10 points. That has the incumbent pursuing a dual-track campaign. As she has at virtually every event, the governor clicked off what she said are her bipartisan goals, like addressing high costs for consumers, securing the border, creating good-paying jobs, and protecting the state's water supply. But Hobbs also focused on convincing those who may be undecided that Biggs is not part of the political mainstream. Trump-endorsed Andy Biggs is one of the most extreme MAGA politicians in the entire country, the governor told her Latino coalition members. She claimed Trump is pushing Biggs to be governor in the swing state specifically to give him a role in overseeing the 2028 election. Terran said that is the kind of message the Latino community, crucial to the governor's victory, needs to hear. The Republicans have worked to purge people from the permanent early voting list, Terran said. Who are the people most impacted when you have that type of anti-democracy legislation, she asked. It's communities of color, communities that usually don't come out and vote. Biggs, for his part, isn't surrendering the Hispanic vote. In fact, he trotted out his Latinos for Biggs group more than a month before Hobbs premiered the Familias Primero coalition with events in Maricopa and Pima counties. Hobbs, however, said her newly created coalition doesn't place her behind the curve, with her formal announcement coming just a day before the Democratic primary election in which she had no opposition. We've been working for over a year on this campaign and building the coalitions in support we need to win, the governor said. Most voters are not turning in yet, she said, so I'm confident that we're running the campaign I need to win. And I'm really proud of the coalition of folks here supporting my re-election. That still leaves the question of how worried she needs to be about Latinos who voted for Trump in 2024, and there were a lot of them. I don't think I've ever seen so many signs from the opposite party, said Maricopa County Supervisor Steve Gallardo of his mostly Hispanic and Democratic neighborhood in West Phoenix. It was unbelievable. Still, he believes that many can be drawn back into the Democratic fold for the upcoming election, saying that many now have a sour taste in their mouth. I think they were sold a bag of goods, Gallardo said, especially Trump's promises to lower costs. I think he was saying whatever he needed to say to get elected, Gallardo said. But at the end of the day, he failed on that part. Gallardo is not alone in thinking the shine has come off Trump in the Hispanic community, and by extension, those like Biggs, whom he has endorsed. In May, Unidos U.S. said its bipartisan poll showed 67% of Latino voters in Arizona disapproved of Trump's job performance. More to the point, 19% who said they voted for the president in 2024 said if they could do it over, they would not vote for him again. Biggs, however, is seeking to blame economic issues on Hobbs. I believe that Donald Trump has delivered more for Latinos than Katie, he said, saying the high cost of housing in Arizona is due to failures to make necessary changes in water laws and to make more state lands available for development. But pollster Mike Noble said Biggs is going to have a hard time selling Arizonans on the idea. He said when people were asked about who to blame for the state's economy, about half said it could be laid at the feet of the current governor. But Noble said the percentage of those who blamed the president was 27 points higher than those who said it wasn't his fault. While Hobbs is moving to boost her support among Hispanics, she also is taking care not to anger potential swing voters who tend to side with Republicans on issues like border security. Consider Proposition 314, which allows state and local police to arrest those who enter the country illegally at other than a port of entry. Hobbs vetoed the measure in 2024, saying it would be harmful to communities and businesses and burdensome for law enforcement. Republican lawmakers did an end run, sending the measure directly to voters, who approved it on a 2-to-1 margin. And Hobbs, talking with reporters at the rollout of Familias Primero, said she won't direct the State Department of Public Safety not to enforce it. As governor, it's my job to enforce the law, she said. and I'm confident that our state troopers are going to enforce that law while still upholding people's rights and without prejudice. Then there's the issue of campaign cash. New financial disclosure reports show Hobbs already has spent more than $11.5 million on her re-election effort. That includes more than $7.5 million in just the past 3 months. That doesn't include more than $2 million spent by Copper State Values, a political action committee run by Nicole DeMont, the same person who's managing Hobbs's gubernatorial campaign. By comparison, Biggs, who had a primary election on Tuesday, has so far spent just $2.4 million, though he has also benefited from nearly $460,000 spent on his behalf by outside groups, most of that from Turning Points. Hobbs, having acknowledged the GOP voter registration edge and her own narrow victory in 2022, said her current level of spending is justified. "We're running the race we need to win," she said. "It's going to take a lot to get there. We know it's going to be a close race." Finally, having a Republican nominee decided by Tuesday's primary, he said, should help free up national funds, especially with Arizona considered by some to be a possible gubernatorial pickup, given how well Trump did last time. New Air Force One from Qatar shelved again. President Donald Trump said Sunday the Qatari-donated jet that serves as an Air Force One plane will soon be sent away for upgrades after questions about the plane's security features. Trump started flying aboard the jumbo jet July 1 after accepting the plane as a gift last year when an accelerated effort to renovate the Boeing 747 for presidential use began. But Trump unexpectedly ditched the plane on a flight from Turkey to the United Kingdom amid rising hostility with Iran on July 8. He flew aboard an older Air Force One to London, but later boarded the new plane to return to the U.S. Trump was asked about whether the newly renovated airplane lacked missile defense capabilities as he returned home from a trip to the FIFA World Cup final in New Jersey on Sunday. "It has a lot of capability," Trump said of the plane, "but as I understand it, in about a month or so, they're going to send it to be maxed out. It'll take about a month." The Air Force did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The new plane, with red, white, and dark blue and gold livery chosen by Trump, was refitted by defense contractor L3Harris Technologies. It's meant to serve as a temporary replacement as Boeing struggles to deliver long-delayed next-generation Air Force One planes. Boeing is working to deliver two purpose-built 747-8s under a $3.9 billion fixed-price contract signed in 2018 that's now 4 years behind schedule and over budget. Delivery of the new planes is expected mid-2028. The upgrades to the jet from Qatar were completed so quickly that some experts expressed concern that the plane may not be as secure as the baby blue Air Force One that preceded it. Critics also questioned the cost and propriety of accepting the gift. And Tucson and region. Court fight targets voucher vote. Supporters of universal vouchers for private, parochial, and homeschooled children are going to court in an effort to stop a public vote to rein in the program. A lawsuit filed Monday by the Goldwater Institute on behalf of four individuals claims there are not enough valid signatures on initiative petitions to put restraints on the voucher system on the November ballot. The initiative, crafted by the Arizona Education Association and Save Our Schools, is designed to reverse much of what lawmakers approved in 2022 when they voted to allow any public school student to get what are called empowerment scholarship accounts. That expansion of the voucher program boosted enrollment to more than 100,000, with a price tag of more than $1 million. It also resulted in multiple news stories about parents using voucher money for items that had no apparent educational purposes. The initiative seeks to rein these in, with provisions requiring greater screening of requests by parents for reimbursements. It also contains a specific list of items that could not be bought with voucher money. But the big change, and the one that has garnered the most opposition, would make universal vouchers off-limit to children in families with income of more than $150,000 a year. Backers of the initiative, called the Protect Education Accountability Act, submitted petitions earlier this month they said, have more than 421,000 signatures to put the issue to voters. They need 259,949 of those to be found valid. County election officials will review a random sample against voter records and then extrapolate how many are presumed valid. But that isn't the last word, with state law allowing anyone to challenge the remaining signatures. In the new lawsuit, attorney Corey Langhofer said he will produce evidence that, after court review, will show the final valid total falls short. Most of the challenges are based on failure of petition circulators to follow state law. For example, Arizona law says anyone who is a paid circulator or from out of state must first register with the Secretary of State's office. Langhofer told the judge that many of the petitions already reviewed show that did not occur. There are also requirements on circulators to provide other information, such as where they can be served with a summons if asked to come to court to defend the signatures they gathered. Langhofer said he had found petitions circulated by those who were convicted of certain criminal offenses and have not had their civil rights restored. In each case, if a circulator is found to have been unqualified, then each of the signatures they gathered cannot be counted. Langhofer said Monday he has already found more than 65,000 signatures that fit that category. He said he expects to add more in the next few days. No date has been set for a hearing by Maricopa County Superior Court Judge David McDowell. The mass shooting suspect was on probation. The suspect arrested in Sunday's mass shooting in downtown Tucson was on probation at the time for a 2024 aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, court records show. At about 2 a.m. Sunday, after a verbal argument, 21-year-old David Leroy French allegedly opened fire into a crowd near East Congress and North 6th Avenue, striking 9 people, an interim complaint said. Police have said that nearby Tucson police officers heard the shots and saw a man, later identified as French, running away from the scene. After giving French verbal commands, an officer opened fire, striking him, police said. 10 people, including French, were taken to a hospital with gunshot injuries, the complaint said. French has since been booked in absentia into the Pima County Jail while he remains hospitalized, the police chief said Monday. No bond had been set as of Monday. Through reviewing surveillance footage, investigators confirmed French was the shooter, the complaint said. French was arrested on suspicion of 9 counts of aggravated assault with a firearm, 9 counts of aggravated assault, and discharging a firearm at a structure, the complaint says. During the 2024 incident, French and some other people were hanging out at a car wash in the early morning of October 6, 2024, when an employee asked them to leave, court records say. French, who had pulled out a rifle, and 2 others confronted the employee. The employee ran away from the group toward the median of a nearby road, court records say. Surveillance footage from the incident shows French pointing the rifle at the employee and firing in his general direction, court records say. And in business, Chipotle opens its first site in Mexico with plans for nationwide expansion. With balloons, confetti, and optimism, U.S.-based CalMex food chain Chipotle has opened its first restaurant in Mexico, bringing its chicken salads and burrito bowls to the homeland of tacos. Chipotle's inaugural restaurant opened in Monterrey's upscale suburb of San Pedro Garza García, a corporate hub known as the wealthiest municipality in Latin America, located in Mexico's northern border state of Nuevo León. A large chili-themed veil was dropped to a burst of confetti, after which crowds of residents queued for a taste of the Californian chain, many taking photos as workers prepared wraps and salads behind a busy bar. Ricardo Aguilar, 26, a Mexican resident who visited on opening day, said he became a Chipotle fan while visiting the U.S. and appreciated the restaurant chain's quality ingredients and robust portions. "It's a different kind of offering," he said. "It's definitely not your street corner taco stand." Chipotle's Mexico director, Pablo de Brito, told Reuters the company planned to open 6 to 8 new stores in Monterrey within the next 14 months, after which it would expand to Mexico City then the rest of the country. "We're more than happy with this opening," he said. noting that Chipotle chose Monterey for the chain's debut, in part because the city provided a young demographic with a close relationship to U.S. culture and familiarity with the brand. Chipotle's entry into Mexico follows two unsuccessful forays by fast food chain Taco Bell, whose efforts to enter the market in 1992 and 2007 were rebuffed as locals snubbed their offerings in favor of authentic Mexican products. Mexico's INEGI Statistics Office counts over 147,000 registered taquerias across the country, but the vast majority of sellers are informal street stands selling various types of meat-based tacos with assorted toppings and spicy salsas. A geographer at Mexico's National Autonomous University, Baruch Sanjins, in 2021, created a map of 1.6 million taco shops, calculating that 95% of Mexico City inhabitants lived within a 5-minute walk of a taqueria. In Monterrey, which has more than 5 million residents in its metropolitan area, the number fell to a still plentiful 75%. For Sara Senatore, senior restaurants analyst at Bank of America, Chipotle's partnership with Alsea, which franchises Starbucks and Domino's pizza locations across Latin America and Europe, is a sign the brand has good prospects in Mexico. They're the ones building the restaurants, and they bear a lot of the risk, she said, noting that Alsea's commitment suggests the brand is considered viable and that a certain cultural mystique often helps U.S. brands fare well abroad. Chipotle's menu, ranging from mild carnitas to a pretty darn hot salsa, should help appeal to a range of palates, Senatore added. Spice is a sensitive topic in Mexico, where a number of sources have become milder due to gentrification, a trend that surged during the COVID-19 pandemic when many U.S. citizens came to Mexico on remote contracts, outspending local residents. Single-family housing starts fall. U.S. single-family home building fell for a third straight month in June, while permits for future construction dropped to the lowest level in 10 months, weighed down by higher mortgage rates and a glut of unsold new homes on the market. Home building also is constrained by rising costs for land and materials. Builders and economists said it would take a while for the housing market to benefit from bipartisan housing affordability legislation Congress recently passed, which, among other provisions, waives or speeds up environmental reviews for construction projects. The bill became law despite President Donald Trump refusing to sign it, demanding that a separate voting bill be passed. The potential uplift to housing starts from streamlining environmental reviews, easing rules on manufactured housing, and encouraging zoning reform will take time to filter through, said Samuel Toombs, chief U.S. economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics. Real residential investment will drag modestly on GDP growth over the coming quarters. Single-family housing starts, which account for the bulk of home building, slipped 2% to a seasonally adjusted rate of 895,000 units, the Commerce Department Census Bureau said Friday. Starts fell in the Northeast, the South, and the Midwest, but rose in the West. Single-family home building dropped 3.2% year-over-year in June. Permits for future construction of single-family homes dropped 2.4% to a rate of 871,000 units, the lowest level since August 2025. They fell 0.2% year-over-year in June. There is limited scope for a strong rebound in permits, with the elevated mortgage rates sidelining potential homebuyers. The rate on the popular 30-year fixed mortgage increased by almost 60 basis points since the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran at the end of February. The rate averaged an 11-month high of 6.55%, data from mortgage finance agency Freddie Mac showed Thursday, as oil prices swung wildly as a shaky ceasefire between the U.S. and Iran collapsed. The brief lull in hostilities boosted consumer sentiment in early July across all age and income groups, as well as political party affiliation, a separate report showed. The University of Michigan's survey of consumers was conducted from June 23 to July 13, with more than 70% of interviews completed before the resumption of war in the Middle East. A National Association of Home Buyers survey on Thursday showed sentiment among single-family home builders remained depressed in July. Though there is a national housing shortage, especially for starter homes, the stock of unsold new homes on the market is back near levels last seen in late 2007 because of a poor spring selling season this year. It felt like builders were finally getting a handle on their inventories, but the clunker of a spring selling season set them back again, said Stephen Stanley, chief U.S. economist at Santander U.S. Capital Markets. As a result, while the level of real residential construction activity should level off soon, the extended downturn that has been in place for 2 years may extend the weakness for another quarter or two. Building permits for multifamily housing projects dropped 4.9% to a rate of 445,000 units last month. Overall, building permits fell 3% to a rate of 1.367 million units. They declined 2.3% year over year in June. The housing drag on the economy was likely offset by strength in consumer spending and business investment in equipment, thanks to an ongoing artificial intelligence build-out and restocking of inventories as firms sought to avoid shortages and higher prices related to the Middle East conflict. AMC posts surprise profit in quarter two. AMC Entertainment turned in a surprise-adjusted quarterly profit, the latest sign that U.S. cinema chains are rebounding, thanks to a strong summer release slate that included blockbusters, the Super Mario Galaxy movie, and Obsession. The largest U.S. theater chain also posted record revenue in the second quarter, saying a $124 million opening weekend at the domestic box office for Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey bodes well for an industry still clawing back to pre-pandemic attendance levels. Its shares rose 18% in morning trading. This is the biggest box office quarter in 7 years and the fifth biggest quarter ever, CEO Adam Aron said of the April-June period. We believe that movie theaters will enjoy, in the full 12 months of 2026, their strongest yet post-pandemic year at both the domestic and the global box office. Backing the view is a packed release slate, with Spider-Man: Brand New Day hitting cinemas at the end of July, and Warner Brothers Discovery's Dune Part 3, and Disney-owned Marvel's tentpole Avengers Doomsday landing in December. Major studios, including Disney and Comcast Universal, have also committed to exclusive theatrical windows for their biggest films, a trend operators have said was driving footfall. For the second quarter, AMC posted revenue of $1.6 billion. Analysts on average estimated $1.47 billion, according to data compiled by LSEG. Adjusted profit per share was 14 cents, compared with expectations for a loss of 6 cents. Six films delivered domestic opening weekend grosses exceeding $75 million, and attendance at AMC's U.S. and international markets rose 12% and about 18% respectively. Still, some analysts question whether the recovery can hold as cinemas face a potentially weaker release slate next year. For 6 years now, moviegoing has struggled to maintain pre-COVID activity. Strong quarters, like this one, will happen now and again. But the industry's struggles will remain, said Ross Benes, senior analyst for TV and streaming at eMarketer. And that brings us to about 12:30 this afternoon. In the opinion section, our letters to the editor. Military testing. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, who imagines himself a warrior, is mandating testosterone tests for older service members. This despite no scientific or logical basis for believing that high T improves performance in the military. By contrast, Ukraine's remarkably effective resistance to Russia's military colossus demonstrates the importance of creativity and technological innovation. if we want to improve our military through testing, maybe we should try testing intelligence instead, starting at the very top, with our commander-in-chief and wannabe secretary of war. On second thought, what would be the point? You can't fix stupid. Gary Woodward, Midtown. Afraid for my gender. First, they supported STARS grabbing us. Then, DEI was eliminated, claiming it was the only reason we held professional, good-paying jobs. Next, they did away with abortions so we would be crippled with unwanted or dangerous pregnancies. Now, the Heritage Foundation recommends doing away with women's sports, claiming they negatively affect our fertility. And Pete Hegseth wants to beef up testosterone levels to further facilitate aggression and assault. Finally, conservatives want to do away with no-fault divorce. So now that they have us unemployed and dependent, we can easily be discarded for a younger model. What is next? Taking away our right to an education and the vote so we can't be uppity or demanding? They are advancing policies for total control of our physical and financial well-being. Wonder what our mandated attire will be, a burqa or Victoria's Secret. Any woman who votes Republican is sentencing all of us to a powerless life of servitude, cruelty, and want. Please don't do it. D. Maitland, Marana. Gun rights. Nowhere in the Bible does it say to never give up your sword for plowshares. It is frequently associated with a quote often attributed to Benjamin Franklin. Those who beat their swords into plowshares usually end up plowing for those who didn't. And as to the Second Amendment, the whole 27 words should be looked at, with commas, starting a centuries-old debate, not just the last part, without a comma presented as a complete sentence. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. Scholars debate whether these commas link gun rights strictly to militia service or protect individual ownership. Mark Goldfeder, Foothills. World Cup. I didn't start out as a soccer fan, but watching this World Cup quickly turned me into an avid viewer. The beauty of the game entirely captured my attention, until I witnessed the tactical gamesmanship of the Argentinian squad and the subpar officiating that accompanied it. American sports fans value fairness above all else. We accept that people will disagree with calls, but we expect rules to be enforced uniformly. In Argentina's recent fixtures, referees completely abandoned this duty, letting cynical fouls disrupt play without disciplinary action. It is incredibly frustrating to see a world-class game decided by who can manipulate the referee rather than who has the better athletic merit. This blatant lack of integrity has left me so disgusted that my enthusiasm for soccer is entirely gone. Unless governing bodies fix these refereeing double standards, I cannot see myself ever tuning into a professional match again. Mike Newman, Northwest Side. International students. The U.S. education system is the envy of the world, and international students come in droves, paying full fare to learn and grow. The Trump administration has decided to make it even more difficult and risky for them to come here. Why? I think the whole effort is driven by xenophobia or racism, and probably both. These students are not criminals and rapists. They are the cream of the crop, highly educated and hardworking, and they deserve better treatment than they're getting. We're telling them, you're not wanted here, go home. I think any international student graduating from a U.S. university with an advanced STEM degree would be offered a green card and a letter that says, welcome to the USA, we're glad to have you. Loring Green, Foothills. Prison system. If any inmate ever learned anything in there, I'd have respect, but nobody does. Prison won't even teach a man to code, which is the perfect way to chew up hours of your life. Why just be idle? Our prisons are a wasted space where evil is allowed to screw every man that walks through the gates, but they won't lift one finger to stop prison rapes. Our prison system is just a lie and a joke. I respect third world countries' systems more. They don't house murderers for decades. That's just plain idiotic. Mary Winkle, Downtown. Mail-in voting. The 21st Century Road to Housing Act overview. The final bill, which became law on July 11, bans large institutional investors from buying additional single-family homes, with exceptions for build-to-rent properties and a HUD renter outreach resource. Bipartisan Policy Center. So build duplexes and apartments. Relaxes regulations on manufactured homes, bigger pieces of junk. Authorizes new programs such as lifting the rental assistance demonstration, RAD, cap by 100,000 units. Extending the CDBG-DR program for 3 years. And creating a new Moving to Work Cohort Bipartisan Policy Center. Wow, a whole 100,000 nationwide. What a big nothing burger. Good try, but no cigar. Bet Bunker Richards, Midtown. Forrest Trump. What kind of craziness is John Fredericks advocating? Mount Rushmore is an epic work of art, not some kind of presidential walk of fame. Regardless of your opinion of the current president, adding him to this iconic masterpiece would be akin to adding his fight, fight, fight statue next to Abe in the Lincoln Memorial, or perhaps inserting him into John Turnbull's classic oil painting of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. Come to think of it, the possibilities are endless. Like Forrest Gump, he could turn up in every artistic depiction of America's historic milestones. Please no. Laura Penny, Foothills. MAGA. Rampant disregard for environmental laws, illegal land seizures, and a leader who seems to care little for the rule of law. He has fueled inflation, spread misinformation, and abused power both domestically and internationally. He has waged unfunded wars, displayed blatant hostility toward minorities and legal immigrants, and dismantled essential healthcare programs. It's troubling to think that 40% of the population still endorses him. His ongoing efforts to silence the media undermine our democracy. Reversing executive orders from previous presidents is wrong. Manipulation of statistics, governing through executive orders rather than working with Congress, high gas prices, a pressing climate crisis, and inflation. Support services have been cut drastically. Budget? What budget? Unlimited money for war. The unnecessary and environmentally unsound wall. Ignoring tribal rights, cutting vital services. Misusing ICE, erasing history. MAGA refers to calamity, disaster, and evil. Japanese. The U.S. national debt has surpassed $39.6 trillion, growing at approximately $15.5 billion per day, or $90 per second. Peter Bishkop, Eastside. Ending the Iran War. The administration seems to be having trouble figuring out how to end its war against Iran. One thing that might help would be to require the president to have the driver of the Beast, a.k.a. Cadillac One, drive to the filling station of the president's choice when it needs gas, and then require the president to hook up the nozzle from the pump of his choice to the limo's gas door and then fill up the tank. The president would then need to pay the price using cash from his own wallet. That way he might get a feel for how much everyday Americans are paying to keep gas in their vehicles in order to get around, as long as Iran limits passage of ships through the Strait of Hormuz. Alan Rule, P.E., Green Valley. The desert. The desert is a thirsty sponge. Its prickly sentinels stand waiting. The rain is patient, falling when conditions are right. When the sky releases its abundance, the plants and animals rejoice. And the plants, their hidden power revealed at last, suck down the falling drops, drinking them deep underground. 30 minutes after the deluge ends, the desert is dry and thirsty again. There is no sign that rain has passed this way. It is a magic trick played by the desert, and it fools us every time. Larry DeWitt, Northeast Side. In national and world news, states accused of fraud. The Trump administration will pause $1 billion in Medicaid payments to California and Minnesota over suspected fraud and non-compliance, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said Tuesday. If those states want that money, they need to provide documentation that these payments are legitimate, he said at a news conference alongside U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Administrator, Dr. Mehmet Oz. CMS deferred about $867.5 million in federal Medicaid payments to California and $199 million to Minnesota, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The pause is the latest in a series of payment suspensions, mostly in Democratic-run states, as Vice President J.D. Vance, Kennedy, and Oz lead a campaign the White House has called an unrelenting war on fraud. Kennedy said the administration suspects much of the questionable California spending involves in-home services. The Minnesota deferrals target 14 high-risk areas the state's own legislative auditor identified as vulnerable to fraud. "If it smells like fraud, we're not paying for it anymore," Oz said. He and Kennedy cited data anomalies and outlier billing patterns, but offered no proof of fraud. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz rejected the move as political retribution against Minnesota, saying the administration was punishing children, seniors, and people with disabilities rather than fraudsters. He said it is cutting more money in health care than they prosecuted for fraud. California Governor Gavin Newsom called the move a recycled political stunt and said in a social media post that California was being targeted for political reasons. He said the state opposes fraud and would collaborate with CMS in good faith efforts to combat fraud, arguing its in-home program saves money by keeping seniors and disabled people out of costlier nursing homes. The deferrals are pauses, not permanent cuts, and do not affect benefits or eligibility. States recover the funds by showing claims meet federal requirements. Minnesota has already returned documents that CMS is reviewing, Oz said. Kennedy said he was also expanding exclusion authority to CMS and the HHS Inspector General, letting them remove bad actors from federal health care programs and potentially ban them permanently. A U.S. brokered deal with Lebanon calls for withdrawal of Israeli military from the south. Lebanese President Joseph Aoun met U.S. President Donald Trump for the first time Tuesday when the two leaders huddled to discuss plans to disarm Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah and secure Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon. Aoun, who served as the commander of Lebanon's U.S.-backed army before being elected president last year, became the first Lebanese head of state to visit the White House in nearly 20 years when he met Trump. His nearly two-hour visit to the White House came as Israeli troops occupy a swath of the country's south and hundreds of thousands of Lebanese remain displaced following Israeli strikes. Hezbollah has rejected the government's direct talks with Israel. "It's been a very badly treated place and country, and we're going to have it properly treated and treated with the respect that it deserves," Trump said, as he met with Aoun in the White House's Oval Office. "There's a Hezbollah problem." Trump also said Tuesday that he was directing his administration to allow all U.S. airline carriers to fly directly to Lebanon. U.S. flights were suspended in 1985 after the hijacking of TWA Flight 847 that was forced to land in Beirut. During the 17-day ordeal, a U.S. Navy diver was killed. In a Washington meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio on Sunday, Aoun said Israel should begin withdrawing from southern Lebanon in line with the U.S. brokered June 26 agreement between Lebanon and Israel. That deal aims to disarm Hezbollah, see a progressive Israeli troop withdrawal, and set the stage for peaceful ties between the two countries. But it remained unclear how Aoun could persuade or force Hezbollah, a Shiite group founded by Iran's Revolutionary Guard in 1982, to give up its weapons. Once Lebanon's dominant political and military force, the group's influence has waned since Israel's 2024 offensive against it. Hours ahead of Aoun's meeting with Trump, Lebanese army troops began taking control of territory vacated by Israeli forces in southern Lebanon, the first test of the plan. A Lebanese official said Aoun believes only Trump possesses the leverage needed to persuade Israel to withdraw its troops and help Lebanon restore its sovereignty. "Washington is Israel's most important ally, and ally and principal arms supplier. The U.S. and Mexico undertake more trade negotiations. U.S. and Mexican trade negotiators launched a third round of bilateral talks Tuesday to try to revise the North American trade agreement, just as President Donald Trump said he would impose new duties on Canada. The talks, which exclude Canada, were set to run for 3 days and are the first formal discussions on changes to the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement since the Trump administration declined to extend the six-year-old regional trade pact on July 1st. The move started a clock to wind down USMCA within 10 years, unless the three countries agree on changes. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce urged Trump to keep intact USMCA's trilateral structure, tariff-free access, and strong enforcement that underpin $1.6 trillion in North American trade. Panel moves forward nominee for spy chief. The Senate Intelligence Committee backed President Donald Trump's nominee, Jay Clayton, to be the U.S. spy chief, the committee's Republican chairman said Tuesday, days after a confirmation hearing in which Clayton refused to acknowledge Democratic former President Joe Biden's 2020 election victory over Trump. Lawmakers also questioned Clayton about his recent subpoenas of New York Times journalists in his current role as U.S. Attorney for Manhattan. Arkansas Republican Tom Cotton said the vote was 9-8. He did not provide a party breakdown, but 9 of the committee's members are Republicans and 8 are Democrats, or an independent who caucuses with Democrats. A full Senate vote was not scheduled. Clayton will need just a simple majority in the 100-member Senate, where Republicans have a 53-47 seat majority, to be confirmed to oversee the 18-agency U.S. intelligence community. The Trump administration was sued Tuesday by 18 Democratic-led states, Washington, D.C., and New York City, over a new federal rule they said would harm the climate by giving companies more time to stop using dangerous hydrofluorocarbons in commercial refrigeration equipment. The U.S. announced a trade deal Tuesday with Jordan that the White House said would remove non-tariff trade barriers and expand market access for U.S. goods. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Tuesday pegged the number of domestically acquired, lab-confirmed U.S. cases of intestinal illness cyclosporiasis since May 1st at 4,173, after officials examined outbreaks, including one linked to lettuce. It is also said it is aware of more than 7,400 additional reported but not yet confirmed cases. In sports, Arizona wages billions in 5 years. As the fifth anniversary of the launch of legal sports betting in Arizona approaches, relaxed restrictions on gambling are here to stay. But how has it affected the state and its residents? As far as money is concerned, it has been immensely profitable. Event wagering, or sports betting, has become easier to access, with sportsbooks only a digital tap away. Over $34 billion has been wagered since the Arizona Department of Gaming, ADG, began tracking event wagering revenue in September 2021. Last year was another record-breaking year, said ADG spokesperson Suzanne Traynor. We had about $9 billion in handle last year alone, she said. On top of sports betting, sportsbooks also earn revenue from fantasy sports leagues. In these leagues, fans compete for prize money based on entry fees, of which the sportsbooks keep a portion. Over $486 million has been spent on fantasy sports fees since September 2021. Sportsbooks aren't the only ones who are making millions from gambling. The state has made over $185 million in fees collected from the money spent. That is not including the revenue made from the Arizona Lottery, which has surpassed $1 billion each fiscal year since 2019. Casinos, which have been a fixture on tribal lands in Arizona for decades, have benefited monetarily from sports betting as well. While their full profits aren't publicly available, their contributions to the Arizona Benefits Fund is. Managed by ADG, the Arizona Benefits Fund takes a chunk of the revenue from tribal gaming and puts it toward public services, including the Division of Problem Gambling and Arizona Wildlife Conservation Fund. In addition to the growing contributions to the Arizona Benefits Fund, there are other clear signs that tribal gaming is benefiting from the legalization of sports betting. Casinos have been seeing more opportunities appear instead of disappear, Trainer said. Huge amounts of money being moved through the industry are indicators that the demand for gambling is higher than ever. That also means there is a higher chance for problem gambling and gambling-related disorders in the state. We want Arizonans to know that if you're having a problem with sports betting or event wagering or casino gaming, you can take that step to self-ban, said Trainer. You can choose a one-year ban, a five-year ban, or a 10-year ban. It's one of many projects alongside others such as 1-800-NEXT-STEP. The ADG is running to try to offset the influx of issues legalized betting causes. Trainer believes that a balance can be struck, predicting four teams that could emerge as contenders in 2026. Every year, NFL teams emerge seemingly out of nowhere to become legitimate Super Bowl contenders. Need proof? Entering the 2025 season, the New England Patriots were viewed as a bottom-barrel team in the AFC. Instead, they managed to enjoy a 10-win turnaround in Mike Vrabel's first season, posting a 14-3 record and making it all the way to Super Bowl 60 before losing to the Seattle Seahawks. The Seahawks were another team that didn't enter the season among the Super Bowl favorites. But in his second season, Mike McDonald molded his defense into that of a true contender, while Sam Darnold delivered a quality first season in Seattle to help power them to a championship win. Granted, the 2025 campaign was particularly unpredictable. Two of the biggest preseason Super Bowl favorites, the Baltimore Ravens and the Kansas City Chiefs, didn't even make the playoffs. Still, the performances of the Patriots and Seahawks serve as a reminder that to all NFL teams that a breakout can happen at any time. Which teams could fit that mold in 2026? Here are four dark horse teams who could emerge as playoff contenders this season if all goes well. The Cincinnati Bengals. The Bengals went just 6-11 last season, but they could emerge as legitimate Super Bowl contenders in 2026. It will largely depend on whether Joe Burrow can stay healthy. Over the last three seasons, Burrow has appeared in 35 out of a possible 51 games for the Bengals. Cincinnati has a 19-16 record in the 35 contests the three-time Pro Bowler has started, but sports a mark of just 5-11 when he isn't on the field. While having Burrow available will be critical for Cincinnati, improving its defense will be too. The unit is ranked in the bottom 12 in defensive EPA in each of the last three seasons, per the NFL's next-gen stats, and checked in at just 29th in the league last season. The Bengals invested a lot to improve their defense in 2026. They traded for Dexter Lawrence and signed Jonathan Allen to improve their defensive tackle group. They also added Boye Mafe and Cassius Howell to play on the edge, while inking local product Brian Cook to provide a much-needed upgrade at safety. Those upgrades are part of why Burrow believes the Bengals will have the most talented roster they've had since he joined the team in 2020. That could be enough to help Cincinnati get back to the playoffs for the first time since the 2022 NFL season and become an under-the-radar Super Bowl contender. The Dallas Cowboys. The Cowboys fit a profile similar to the Bengals. Dallas sports an excellent offense headlined by Dak Prescott, Javonte Williams, and one of the best receiver duos in the league, CeeDee Lamb and George Pickens. The issue for the Cowboys last season was that their defense struggled immensely under the leadership of Matt Eberflus. The unit ranked dead last in defensive EPA per play, per the NFL's next-gen stats, and badly missed Micah Parsons, who was traded on the eve of the 2026 season. With that in mind, Dallas was aggressive in upgrading its defense during the offseason. It drafted blue-chip safety prospect Caleb Downs in the first round of the 2026 NFL draft and added several potential veteran starters to its unit, including edge rusher Rashawn Gary, linebacker D. Winters, and safety Jalen Thompson, among others. That infusion of talent may not turn the Cowboys' defense into an elite unit, but it should get it closer to the average to above average range. That could go a long way toward helping Dallas challenge for another NFC East title and become a potential contender. The New Orleans Saints. If any team is going to come out of nowhere to earn a playoff spot, it will probably be in the NFC South. None of the teams in the division last season had a winning record, which allowed the 8-9 Carolina Panthers to emerge as the division winners. The NFC South race remains wide open, but the Saints may be the most intriguing team in the race. Kellen Moore did a yeoman's work with an undermanned squad last season, and New Orleans actually posted a winning 5-4 record with rookie Tyler Shaw as its starter. The Saints spent the offseason building around Shaw, adding Travis Etienne, a versatile running back, and David Edwards, a strong left guard, in free agency to support him. They also spent a first-round pick on Jordan Tyson to serve as a number two receiver across from Chris Olave, which filled one of the team's biggest holes from last season. All that should allow New Orleans to take another step forward on offense, while the Saints' defense, which ranked 11th in defensive EPA per play last season, should remain solid once again. And New Orleans' schedule, which is on paper the second easiest schedule league-wide in 2026, should only aid in the team's quest to make it back to the playoffs for the first time since Drew Brees' final season in 2020. And the Minnesota Vikings. The Vikings went 9-8 in 2025, but their performance was viewed as a disappointment. Minnesota had gone 14-3 the previous season under Sam Darnold, but saw its offensive productivity and efficiency wane considerably in J.J. McCarthy's first season as an NFL starter. The Vikings decided to bring in proven competition for McCarthy in 2026 because of his struggles. The 23-year-old will be given a chance to compete with Kyler Murray for the starting job, and the winner of that battle could give Minnesota a chance to emerge as a strong bounce-back candidate in 2026. Minnesota still has the makings of a quality offense. It has an excellent receiver trio of Justin Jefferson, Jordan Addison, and Juwan Jennings, while TJ Hockenson remains an effective tight end. The team also sports a solid offensive line and a decent two-headed monster at running back in the form of Aaron Jones and Jordan Mason. So average to above-average quarterback play could help the Vikings climb their way back into the playoff race. Questions exist about how the Vikings will be able to deal with some key departures on defense. Longtime safety Harrison Smith is gone, while veteran defensive tackles Jonathan Allen and Javon Hargrave became cap casualties. Nevertheless, Brian Flores remains one of the league's best defensive coordinators. He should be able to turn Minnesota's stop unit into an effective and maybe even fearsome one, while Kevin O'Connell remains a bright, young offensive mind who should raise both the team's floor and ceiling. The Vikings may not get a lot of love entering 2026 season because of their uncertainty at quarterback, but make no mistake, this is a team that could exceed expectations and challenge for a playoff spot if all goes well. And this has been a reading of the Arizona Daily Star. My name is Roland, your volunteer reader at Sun Sounds of Arizona, wishing you a pleasant day.